Please have in front of you Revelation chapter 20, verse 11. Now, as we've said many times in this series, the book of Revelation is a picture book. It's a series of overlapping pictures. And these last chapters that we've been looking at them, we've witnessed some extraordinary pictures, vivid pictures. We've witnessed the final destruction of Babylon and the imminent marriage of Christ and the church. We've watched the last battle, Armageddon. We're told of it in chapter 19, and we saw there the church, spoken of as the bride of Christ, and there she is besieged by fierce and cruel enemies who are waiting to tear her to pieces. And when all seems lost, we find the gates of heaven are opened. And we ask, who is this riding on a white charger, riding at the head of the armies of heaven? And it's the Lord, and he's coming to rescue his bride. And as he rides, so his and our enemies fall under his feet. And he's wonderful, invincible, glorious. And as the last enemy falls, he gathers up his bride just as he said he would. And the two lovers are united forever. And then the same battle is told again in chapter 20 from a new angle. Only this time it includes the destruction of Satan himself. He's the great architect of this rebellion. And we read in chapter 20 of his destruction. And we spent two Wednesdays on chapter 20 thinking about the meaning and significance of these 1,000 years, what's called the millennium. These 1,000 years during which Satan is chained. We read, don't we, verse 3, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years were finished. And we've looked at it, we've taken at first a traditional amillennial view, although we've mentioned in passing other views, postmillennial, premillennial. We've taken a traditional amillennial view, but then we've, as you saw last time, we tweaked it around a bit and made some changes to it, which we felt and hoped were more in keeping with what the passage said. You'll have to get the tape, we won't go into it now if you want to find out more. But we read then at the end of verse 7, the 1,000 years come to an end. Now the 1,000 years aren't literal. The 1,000 represents a complete, a perfect length of time. Now, when the 1,000 years have expired, Satan will be released from his prison. And so again, we have this last battle, but it's now from a new angle. And he will go out and deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. Now, they went up from the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Satan, having been unable to deceive the nations for these symbolic 1,000 years, he is now free at the end, for a little while, as it's called in verse 3, to deceive the nations again. And that 1,000 years of lost opportunity, he compresses into that little while. This little while of extraordinary satanic activity which will be revealed at the end. And we find that he unites the nations as never before in one great global alliance, one pan-human conspiracy against the Lord and against his people. And they gather to make war on the church, spoken here of as the camp of the saints, the beloved city. It's not literal armies encamping around a literal city. But it's simply saying the whole world at the end will be militantly anti-Christian. It will be as it was in the days of Rome, where wherever Christians were, they were within reach of the persecuting authorities. As it was then, so it will be. That day anticipates this day. Wherever you are in the world, Satan will be able to wage war upon the people of God. It'll be a worldwide persecution. It'll be the final showdown, the last battle. And verse 8 talks of Gog and Magog. It's a reference back to Ezekiel 38 and 39, a reference back to a time of terrible persecution of the people of God, instigated by Antiochus Epiphanes. That day, when the people of God were persecuted by him, anticipates that those final days, Satan's little while. And if you look at verses 8 and 9, his power appears to be boundless, doesn't it? He will go out to deceive the nations which are in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, whose number is as the sand of the sea. They went up on the breadth of the earth and surrounded the camp of the saints and the beloved city. The four corners of the earth, all the nations are involved, whose number is as the sand of the sea. It talks about the breadth of the earth. And here are the people of God, and surrounded the camp of the saints in the beloved city. People of God surrounded. The odds seem impossible. And just when victory seems to be finally his, he'll be overthrown, never to return. And fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. Verse 10, the devil who deceived them was cast into the lake of fire and brimstone where the beast and the false prophet are, and they will be tormented day and night forever and ever. Daniel speaks of it in these words. Huge overlap between Daniel and Revelation. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book. So the scene closes, doesn't it, as we come to verse 11, not with our eyes upon Satan, but on the power of God. And we read here, fire. Fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. And when we read of the Lord's return, Jesus himself says, for as lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. Jesus rides to the rescue of his people. He's coming again, and he will have the last word and destroy Satan and all his works and gather up his bride and take her home to heaven. It's the close of another picture, isn't it? But then we've had this reading, and it's another picture. We're going from picture to picture. John says, then I saw. So as we read it, we need to use our eyes, don't we? Revelation's a seeing book. We get two sides involved in the detail. What does this mean? What does that say? It's a book that we see. We watch. Well, it's this great thing of Christ riding for his bride. It's a wonderful picture, isn't it? We all understand it. A great king on his horse, on a charger, riding to rescue a bride. That's the level at which the book is working. So John sees. Well, what do you see, John? And I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it. The war is over. Satan is defeated. What happens next? It's the last judgment. A great white throne and him who sat on it. After the Second World War, the Nuremberg trials were held, where 21 Nazis were tried in person for war crimes. Now, many of them were guilty beyond doubt. But at the trial, it was the place where justice was seen to be done. That was the point. The guilt of a number of them already was so clear, but it was the place where justice was seen to be done. And the evidence was mustered. And the books were opened. And the witnesses were called. And those who were found guilty were sentenced by the judge. Everyone could see that justice was being done. And then they were delivered to be punished. The end of the Second World War. A world war. Well, here is the world war, isn't it? And the world war is now over. And yes, the one that organizes great conspiracy, this Hitler-like figure, Satan, has been destroyed and defeated. But what of those who freely sold themselves into his service? What of those who are his confederates, who have united with him in his rebellion against the lawful authority, against the king and against his son and against the king's laws and against the king's people? What of all those who've committed treason? What of them? Well, it's the last judgment. If we believe that in this world the guilty should be called to account, if we believe in this world that judges should sit and pronounce sentence upon the guilty, if we believe in this world that evil should be condemned and the wicked should be punished, we can have no objection to the last judgment. Our justice system is simply a reflection of the justice of God. and there will be final justice. This is the grand assize, where God himself sits as judge. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it. And the next words, I think, are there. It's a misused word, awesome, isn't it? But these words are awesome. Overwhelming. Because look at what it says next. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, from whose face the earth and heaven fled away. And there was found no place for them. With a look, he dismisses this creation. This to us vast universe is dismissed with a look. And they flee away. But if heaven and earth flee away, this is perhaps more awesome, isn't it? There is nowhere for men and women to flee away. He only has to look, and creation scatters. But the men and women of this world cannot scatter. There is nowhere for them to run. They all gather and stand before him. No one escapes his gaze. And I saw, verse 12, the dead, small and great, standing before God. Who is this? It's everyone. Everyone who has ever lived. Is anyone missing? No. Verse 13, the sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them. We can take other scriptures and we know by now that at this last judgment that everyone is clothed with resurrection bodies. We were made body and soul. The soul without the body is naked, as Paul describes it. The state of man is body and soul. When we die, body and soul are separated. At the last judgment, body and soul are reunited. It's a resurrection body. Now for some, those resurrection bodies will be glorious. For some, those resurrection bodies will be shameful. Now, Jesus stands at the tomb of Lazarus. With a loud voice, he says, Lazarus, come forth. And Lazarus does. But why does Jesus say, Lazarus, come forth? Why doesn't Jesus simply say, come forth? Because that's right, at the voice of the Son of God, all the dead would have risen at that point. So he says, I'm only calling Lazarus. Lazarus, come forth. Then was not the time. But now the time has come. Jesus says, do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth. So it's everybody is there. Everybody. All who are in the graves will hear his voice and come forth, those who have done good to the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil to the resurrection of condemnation. The hour has now come. Now some, of course, have not been buried, have they? How many died in the flood? Or on the Titanic? Or HMS Hood when she blew up? So we read, the sea gave up the dead who were in it. But wherever people's bodies lie, and again, it's pictorial language, isn't it? Death must surrender up its prey. The sea gave up the dead who were in them, and death and Hades delivered up the dead who were in them. Death delivers up its prey. And Hades, it's simply the state of the disembodied soul, the disembodied spirit after death. When I die, my body will, wherever it will be, it'll decay, it'll return to the dust. My spirit goes somewhere. The state, not the place. When talking about Hades, it's not talking about a place. It's more talking about a state. The state of my disembodied spirit is Hades. It's controlled by the context. So for some, the rich man, the context there is that actually he's suffering. He's under the judgment of God. For those who are the Lord's people, they're present with the Lord. But it's the disembodied state, if I can put it like that. So death will deliver up its prey, and Hades will be emptied out. It's picture language, isn't it? The sea gave up the dead who were in it, and death and Hades delivered up the dead in them. In other words, it's saying this. It's saying it very simply. It's saying wherever people died, whenever they died, wherever they are now, body and spirit will be united in the resurrection, and everyone will come to judgment. There's no one left. There's someone over there, and there's someone over there. Wherever the dead are, they're all gathered up. All who ever live will be there before the throne of judgment. No one will be missing. And I saw the dead, small and great, standing before God. Think of it, Adam will be there. And there will be a child, will be the last child ever born in this world. It's a thought, I was thinking about that today. I was thinking, it's going to be a baby born somewhere. It'll be the last birth ever. It's a thought, isn't it? So from Adam to the last one that's ever born, and everyone in between, everyone's going to be there. There'll be Abraham and Judas. There'll be the Emperor Nero. There'll be the Apostle Paul. There'll be Mary, Queen Victoria, Richard Dawkins, John Lennon, and of course the billions of the unknowns, great and small. There'll be John, JFK, Pol Pot, everyone. And therefore there'll be you and me. We will all be there. And all be there. No one escapes. All of us are there. And then what? Well, verse 12, we're told, and the books were opened. Again, it's picture language. It's the display of the evidence of every life ever lived, recording every thought, every word, every deed, every motive, and whatever anything else is doesn't come under that. Everything in every life will be on display. The books are opened because justice must be seen to be done, because God is just. A friend of mine's a headmaster, and not headmasters do, they call you into their study, don't they, when you're in trouble. And in the school they've got CCTV, closed circuit television. So someone comes into his study, did you do that? And the lad or lass might say, no, I didn't do that. So he says, okay, and then he presses the button, and on the screen comes a CCTV footage of them doing it. And the head goes down and they don't say any more. Or he was telling me a situation where there were some who accused another of doing something very serious. They looked at the CCTV footage. They had they're saying the time, the place, all the rest of it. It was recorded, and this person was completely innocent. And they were fabricating lies against this particular person. So not only does it condemn, but it also proves people's innocence, doesn't it? The books are opened. CCTV, video evidence, everything is there. Justice is seen to be done. And the books were opened, and the dead were judged according to their works by the things which were written in the books. Verse 13, and they were judged each one according to his works. You think about that. Some people who are there have been dead for thousands and thousands of years. But nothing's forgotten. Everything's been recorded. And they stand before God, answering for the life that they've lived here. In that sense, death doesn't change you, doesn't morally reform you. Where you are at death is where you are. What you've done in this life is the basis, is the evidence upon which you will be judged. At death, people don't become better people and all be put right. They're judged on the life they've lived to death. And therefore those who are unrepentant and unbelieving here will be found to be unrepentant and unbelieving there. Those who took the road to hell here should not expect to find themselves going to heaven there. So on that day when the books are opened, and men and women are sentenced to hell, they're condemned already, but justice is being seen to be done. The judge will pronounce the sentence. No one's going to say, yeah, but, because the books are open. The CCTV evidence is there. It can all be seen. Those were your thoughts. Those were your words. Those were your motives. That is the life that you lived. And the degrees of hell, the depths of hell, that'll all be clear as well, because the evidence will be on display. The reason will be publicly given. Justice will be seen to be done, and they were judged each one according to his works. And everyone is judged. Paul writes to the Corinthians, and he says this, "For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive the things done in the body." In other words, in this life, according to what he has done, whether good or bad. All of us are there. But not all go to hell. Because another book is opened, isn't it? Look at verse 12 again. "And the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life." So who's in that book? Who's in that book? Is it the good people? Is it those who've never sinned? Is it those whose good works are more than their bad works? Is it those who are really sincere and religious and devout? No, if you read that book, and it will be read, the book of life, you'll find in it names like King Nebuchadnezzar, who was made an image of gold and wanted people to bow down and worship him. You'll find King Manasseh, who sacrificed his own sons to the god Molech and slaughtered a very great number of believers in Jerusalem. You'll find in there one who called himself the chief of sinners, Paul. You'll find in there the dying thief, who could never live a life again. He only had seconds before he died. I read of a missionary who took the gospel to some unreached people, and one of the women there said, "I wish I'd heard this good news earlier. I've killed 19 of my own children." Names like that are in that book. It's a book which names some of the greatest sinners of all, the chief of sinners. It's those who know they can't prove their innocence on Judgment Day. It's those who know they're guilty, wicked, sinful. There's no reason ever why God should have any regard for them. But they fled to Jesus Christ and they found another righteousness. The righteousness which is through faith. As Paul says, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. So there is another book, and we'll talk about that later on in Revelation, not this evening, because it comes back to it. It talks about the Lamb's Book of Life later. So it's wonderful. All are guilty. All are sinners, but not all are condemned to hell, because there's a Book of Life in which guilty sinners who fled to Jesus, their names are recorded, and all is forgiven, all is washed clean, and they stand acquitted at the judgment because of him. So what happens to those then whose names are not written in the book of life, whose guilt is beyond doubt, and upon whom the sentence is passed by the judge? Well, we read verse 14, "Then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire." So it says death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. Now death and Hades are personified, aren't they? Spoken of as other people. They're not. But death. Death is separation of body and soul. Hades is the state of separation where body and soul are apart. It's saying that death and Hades will forever come to an end. What does it mean? Well, it's saying this. Look, I live. I die. I become a disembodied spirit. I'm resurrected. It's change, change and change again. But all that change will go. All that which is to do with change is going to be thrown into the lake of fire. Beyond that, there's no change. The things which bring about change are thrown into the lake of fire. In other words, it's saying that after the judgment, this is it. There's no change. When you cast in the lake of fire, you don't then undergo another death, or another setting, or another situation, and there's going to be a change after that. That's it. It's the eternal state. The state into which you go into that lake of fire is a state in which you will remain forever and ever and ever. Because those things which make for change go into the fire with you. Does that make sense? The death, then death and Hades were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. So beyond this death is a second death. There's a death that follows this death. Now think about that. What does death do? Again, it's talking about a change of state, isn't it? When a person dies, they pass into a new realm. Sometimes when people are around someone and they're dying and they die, they say they've gone. They've gone. They've passed somewhere. They've gone somewhere. They're no longer here. They're somewhere else, and they can't come back. The condemned, where do they go? Well, if they're no longer here, where will they be? The lake of fire. And there's no third death that moves them on from there. That's the second death. That's it. That's it. It's final. There's no change, no return. That's where they remain. What's more, death isn't only a change of state going from here to there. Think about death. It doesn't just speak about separation, does it? Moving from one place to the other. It speaks of punishment. The wages of sin is death. Think about death in this life. What sort of words come to your mind when you think about death in this life? Looking on grief, loss, suffering, weakness, decay, corruption, pain, separation, helpless, tears, curse, ruin, anguish, regret, waste. We can find a lot of words very quickly, can't we? The first death. That's just the first death. That's just the death in this world. We talk of the bitterness of the grave, don't we? It is bitter. It's awful, awful, awful when people die. But that's just a faint echo of the second death, isn't it? It's not that this is the first death and the second death is based on the first death. It's that that's the real death. And this is the echo of that real death. So think about that. If you can distill all the sorrows and anguish and grief and tears and regret and pain and all the things that can curse, if you can distill it all from the first death and then make it something that's infinite and make it something that's everlasting, then you're beginning to get a sense of what the second death is, aren't you? What will it be when the ungodly are cast onto God's rubbish heap? That's the sense of it. Gehenna is the rubbish heap. Jesus talked about Gehenna, didn't he? Where the worm doesn't die and the fire isn't quenched. He's talking about a valley outside Jerusalem where they used to burn the rubbish. And obviously in any rubbish tip there's lots of worms, maggots. This is God's rubbish heap. The fire never goes out. It's where he throws the rubbish. And it burns forever. And it's a lake of fire, isn't it? It's not something which is a puddle or a pond. Something which someone may well be able to cross and get out of. And it's cast. You throw rubbish down. You throw it away. It's incinerated. What goes in never comes out. What goes in forever. To be burned forever. Under the wrath of God. It's the second death. Remember Isaiah's question. He says, who among us shall dwell with the devouring fire? Who among us shall dwell with everlasting burnings. It's picture language. But therefore the reality is all the more awful, isn't it? Anyone not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. Well, let's close. A few years ago, I went to Tate Britain. And I went to look, really, at one picture in particular I was after, I wanted to see. It's called The Great Day of His Wrath by John Martin. And it's a very large canvas. It's a really big picture, really big painting. And it is what it says. It's the Great Day of His Wrath. It's a depiction of the Last Judgment and the wrath of God breaking upon the wicked. And as I looked at that canvas, I could have measured it, couldn't I? Could have got a tape measure out and said, well, these are the dimensions. Could have looked at the colours and said, well, look, that, what sort of colour is that? Is that that's a red and that's a black and that's an orange and the subtleties of the colours. I could have looked at that. I no doubt could have turned to the people next to me. I could have talked at length about this picture. And there could have been all sorts of ways of looking at it and measuring it and thinking about it. But actually, I just stood in front of it and looked. And looked, and looked, and looked. And I found myself going away, and I came back and looked again. To look at it. Here in chapter 20 is a large canvas. It is here not for polishing up my systematic theology. It's not here so that I can get a grip on my eschatology. So I know about the end times and I can talk about it. It's a picture for looking at. And maybe going away and coming back and looking at it again. And looking at it and not taking your eyes away from it. And yes, there is a sense in which as I look at that picture, to put myself in that picture. To stand in that picture. To be there. So Christian friends, as you look at this picture, what do you think? What do you think now when Jesus says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it is more profitable for you that one of your members perish than your whole body to be cast into hell. And Christian friend, what do you think now? Of all your grumbles and complaints that the Christian life is hard and it's costing you too much. And what do you think now about the urgency of making the gospel known? My friends, my family, my neighbours. Well, who's going to tell them if I don't? And what do you think now of the Lord Jesus Christ? Robert Murray McShane, we sing a hymn, don't we? Some of the verses are missed out. The second verse of that poem we know well says this, when I hear the wicked call on the rocks and hills to fall, when I see them start and shrink on the fiery deluge brink, then, Lord, shall I fully know, not till then, how much I owe.